Accession number 28736, reel number 1.
I now went round on a regular basis to Hither Green School, which was a regular London County Council elementary school, and only a very short distance to run round to them. And we started with a sort of sing-song in the hall. There were three floors. The ground floor was the infants, then the boys, and then the third floor, top floor, was the girls. They were all made, I should think, by the same architect or designed by him, because there were hundreds of these schools all over London. And then I stayed there for 2 years and got on quite well, and messenger boy, starting at Savoy Hill and moving over to Broadcasting House in Portland Place some time later. 1931 I started, January 1931 at Savoy Hill, and I stayed with the BBC until it was pretty hard to think, but probably only 2 years. I used to have a reference from them, but I put in a word for Buster so that when he left school he was able to go and get a similar job, at which he did very well, I believe, until he subsequently to Granny's great sorrow, he joined the Navy in 1938, but he'll have to talk about his little bit himself one day. What else did I do? Yes, I joined the Territorial Army in March 1934, and I wasn't yet 18, so I was 17 when I joined. But we used to go around there one or two evenings a week, and sometimes I did a weekend exercise with them. I joined their regimental survey party, so I picked up some trigonometry and some geometry there. So I was learning all the time, and I used to go to other evening classes, and we all belonged to a club, Buster and Wally and I, called the Symbic, which stood for the St. Swithin's Young Men's Bible Institute and Club. And we first of all used to have our meetings in the coal hole of the St. Swithin's Church, where they kept a lot of coke and stuff and a very dirt. And there were several very good people there who ran this club, and we used to do little shows on and put them on the stage. We had dances, and old Kit taught me to dance the waltz and quick step. So I did learn the tango after a style, but I don't think it was there. And we were generally breaking out a little bit, but I was always remember being pretty happy, and a lot to do, because I went to evening classes for everything, really, and generally tried to educate myself a little bit more from, because I missed, I was aware that I'd missed those other 2 years of schooling when we went solely on a casual basis.
Where did you go to work when you left the BBC?
Ah, well, this Mr. Brearley, who was a dentist and an old time, he was the dentists then followed on from being a chemist or something like that. They weren't qualified as dentists are nowadays, so they didn't have a university degree like LDS, RCS. They didn't have to have that. They were just registered dentists, and they had to register without it. So it probably pretty primitive, but he was very experienced, and his father did the same thing before him. So I guess he had a lot of experience there. Anyway, I worked with him probably for 4 years, and then I went, he really got me a job with the Cottrell and Company, which was a family dental manufacturing company, and fairly soon I was their assistant buyer. But it was a very poor job, really, and I really had sort of settled down into not very much. Having joined the territorials, I got on well there, and so that when, by the time war broke out, which still quite surprised me, unlike Wally, who seemed to know everything that was going on, it gave me a rather nasty shock to think that I was in the field artillery, and was promptly sent overseas with my regiment, where I had a very nice time in France. So that was at the end of September 39, the time I went. I was called out earlier with the territorials as a key man on the 25th of August 1939. So
did you have a rank?
All about it. I was a full sergeant, and that meant that I had a good rank.
You were 21?
Certainly, yes, 23, I think. By now it was 39, 22 certainly.
Okay.
And I was very sure of myself as far as the gunnery and the guns were concerned, and was a lot of the time the senior sergeant, so that I was in charge of the troop from time to time.
And what were you called? Were you a regiment or were you
No. The regiment was called the 91st Field Regiment, and they were a part of the 2nd Corps in France, which, being corps troops, meant you had to go wherever the need was greatest, and the need was greatest everywhere. Then it was something of a shambles, and we were cut off. And in my sight of the Germans were that they were really rather better than us. They seemed to have better equipment. Ours was all left over and altered from the 1914 war. A typical example, and although I didn't have spurs during the war, but I was issued when I joined the regiment with 2 spurs. Spurs, mark you, for dealing with horses, but one was marked 1914 and one 1916, and our guns were similarly dated, and or did they had various alterations and changes done to them? So they would have been 18-pounders in the First World War. We put in bigger barrels and called them 25-pounders because we were firing 25-pound shells.
How did you get to France?
We went over on a ship from Southampton, and I hated it. I swore I'd never go back to England because it was very rough, and we went round and round in circles going across there to Cherbourg, from Southampton to Cherbourg, if I remember rightly, and it was a very rough and sick-making trip as far as I was concerned. And then Dunkirk?
Angel.
Oh, yes. Two or three of us, met a French family in one of the villages where we were. And before the war broke out, as it were, and they used to have us over to their place every night if we could. They were really wonderful to us, and a typical marvellous French family made me always very attached to the French. This is unusual perhaps, and I don't like seeing them disparaged at all. Yes, and then we had to go and fire our guns at the try and stop the Germans coming through, and this got very awkward, and we were all incredibly tired, and our supplies were cut off from our supplies, and we were told that we were going to have to go home, in fact, and if we could. And this meant going down to Dunkirk or to the beach and getting off somehow. And at that stage, I was wounded. Now, Wally had been wounded the day before.
Now?
Yeah. We went, first of all, to a place called Derville, where we were under an open shed, and we had our troop in there, and were firing quite a lot from there. There was another troop to our right front, and their gun, one gun, and its surroundings had caught fire. And they had to leave that area. So they left the area with the guns in position. And then sometime later, I was sent back with a small truck to take the end gun, number 4 gun it would have been, out, get it out. And they didn't give me any very much to go with, but they sent one 1500 weight truck and sort of round the corner, and I walked down to where it was, and there wasn't much of a fire, there's camouflage netting all about and so on. So the driver came, and I unhooked the car. We had to slide little bolts out from underneath that were holding it down, and we hooked the gun into the back of his truck, and he was able to drive it out. So he took it out. By this time, I was being shouted at by my own troop to get back to the troop again, as they wanted to get busy. And so I went back again. And that's probably about Derville. Then we moved out from that position altogether and round to another, and my last position with the regiment then. But we had a place in a field immediately in front of a wood, and we were quite heavily shelled there, and some bombing as well, and we were firing all the time, and we stayed through all that day and the night, and then very early the next morning, say 5 o'clock, we got the order to move out. By this time, our little bit of infantry were coming back, and they were very hot and exhausted, but I tried to hold them just a little bit while we had time to get our guns out, but they weren't having any of that, and they said that the Germans are on our heels now, and best thing is to get out, and they were quite right, of course. And our people, I already had got my gun out. I felt only personally for my gun. So I'd got that out on the road, facing in the right direction, and I left everybody in it, all my team, in the truck. And I just said, wait there, and I'm going to nip back and see if I can give them a hand, because there were still two guns left in the position. But they were in the mud had built up, probably through me going out and the other gun that got out. And there were two there with nobody. There was a dead white chicken hanging over the barrel of one of the guns. So somebody, we were getting our own food as far as we could then. And I attempted and succeeded in getting the back plates off both the breeches of both these guns. And all I did with them, they were heavy pieces of solid steel, and I threw them as far as I could into this muddy paddock, and I could, by this time I could see these Germans coming, and I think they had skull and crossbones. No. Anyway, that's what it appeared to me, and they were coming through the position then, and so I left the guns, and I was the only one really on our side, and I went back and was trotting along the ditch by the side of the road when I was shot, and this gave a rather unpleasant burning sensation, and I fell forward, and now I was in a good safe position, except I was drowning because there was just a couple of inches of water and the face was in it, so I thought there was no point in drowning, and I managed to turn myself over on my back, so I was now wet through down the front and wet through down the back, altogether wet through.
What did you have in your hands?
So I had I had in a pair of pliers in one hand and a little wooden handled screwdriver in the other hand, which I'd been using to undo split pins on these blessed breeches. So it was pretty impossible, and Also, I was the only one there, so it wasn't any good calling for help. But if I had, I couldn't really breathe much because I found I was, later I found I was functioning on this one lung and thoroughly unwell. So I had my stripes up in front of me and my own little brass gun and waited, facing the Germans. And they had bayonets, little short, nasty-looking bayonets, which I was expecting possibly one of them would poke in me. But in fact, they didn't come. They went through the guns and off to the left where there was a wood, and through that. And then I sort of heard something behind me, which is where we, the British troops, were, and there was a little lone infantryman coming up with his rifle well in front of our Devon regiment, possibly. But I don't remember what regiment he was with. But he knelt down in the ditch and had a look at my chest, which is where this bullet had come out. And he took my field dressing out of my pocket and put it on the front wound. So I nodded and my thanks and so forth, and he went on a bit further, and presently he said, "I'll get somebody to pick you up." And I said, "That'd be lovely." I didn't say that, of course. But anyway, so two stretcher bearer types appeared, and they carried me up the hill now, and this exposed us all. When I down in the ditch, I was pretty well very safe, and I could put my head up just a bit and look round and see things exploding and around us. And up on this hill, the sergeant major, a new type, WO3, and very nice man, he came and he said, "I'm sorry, I have to take these two men of yours, but I'll get somebody back for you." And sure enough, he did, and I was very glad of that. And they carried me over, so now I was out of sight, of line of sight for the firing. And we went down into a dip, and one of our trucks came along, terribly laden with people, no room at all. But they forced me in and got on the side of it and held on themselves. And we went back to the first regimental aid post, where I was placed on the table and looked at by two doctors. And the chaplain appeared. By this time I could hear old Wally talking in the background, and I said to the chaplain, "That's my brother there, and perhaps you should I'll send him over." And then presently Wally appeared, and whether he spoke, well, he certainly spoke, he used to speak a lot, but they must have known that we were brothers, and they got us both into an ambulance, which was very over full. There were four bunks, and about six or eight people sitting and squatting and standing up around inside this ambulance, and we made our very slow way down to the coast, backwards and forwards around this road and that road, and we got down to the coast and went into the basement of what I think had been hotel before, and the basement was where the cars were parked, and they'd cleared everything out, and so we were down there on our stretchers, and we were having ample supplies of morphine. And then the following day, Wally was taken off. Now, he was perfectly all right. He could walk about and everything like that. But they people who were taking him off didn't know that. And so they carried him off. And they carried him out to sea and held him over his head so he didn't get wet and got him onto a boat. As I said before, everybody was so tired they could sleep through anything. And of course they did. So Wally got home, of which he was very upset, because he felt then that he'd left me, as it were, deserted me on the beach. But my chaps weren't very good there, and they didn't carry me off at all, and they let me get soaking wet in the sea, and went off for a cigarette. So I managed to get them back, and I said, just take me back where I was. And they did. And so that was that. This Dunkirk was really a very noisy place. They were blowing up the ammunition that was there so the enemy didn't get it. And the enemy was shelling us and bombing us. And so it was a really impossible place to live. For some reason, they moved us from this hotel to another place where we had some anti-aircraft guns on the top of it. And it was some sort of pierhead and entertainment centre, because it had a big oval glass roof, and we were put under there. But somehow the medical corps who were running this maintained some sort of order. They may have had a Red Cross on it, and which may or may not have been respected. But anyway, we were in it, and an English woman had made some bread and butter and jam sandwiches. It's quite remarkable that anybody bread, it seemed to be quite fresh bread, and it was the first thing I'd had to eat for 4 days now. So I loved it, and that was very nice. And a chap named Frank brought a bowl with water in and washed my face. I took his address, or he gave me his address and took my address, and we wrote, but I never saw him again. I was there again for whatever length of time. This is it's not an accurate description or any details are not really right, you can't remember. But I know that I was carried from there, or carried everywhere. I wasn't walking, because this sort of my legs seemed to be paralysed or something like that. I was carried, and we went along. There was a commander, Royal Navy, who was controlling who went out on this pier completely, and there were a number of people in various, of various ranks who wanted to get away, and they wanted to go up and get on a boat, but this bloke wouldn't let them. He ignored all rank and just let who was authorised by his commander, I suppose. And anyway, we were passed along there, and I remember a little dog came with us. I don't know who he belonged to, and I was put on a ship, which was a hospital ship, and I had a bunk with a porthole, really very comfortable, and it was a beautiful morning, and I think it was